Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. If you like, feel free to come a little closer. I won't call you by name. You know who I'm talking to. But you're welcome to move a little closer, but we'll go ahead and get started. Thank you for coming to this session this morning. This session we're really excited about. We have a chance to talk with you more about MARI, which is the Minority HIV/AIDS Research Initiative that's been funded through CDC since 2003. We're having a great year so far this year. We're celebrating 10 years of funding investigators, early career investigators who are external to CDC working, doing community-based research. And so today you're going to hear from four currently funded MARI investigators, and then we're going to finish up with me giving you a little bit of more detail about MARI and talking about the next steps for MARI. So again, thank you for coming. So first up, we're going to hear from Dr. Brigitte Bronner. Dr. Bronner is an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. She graduated with a BSN from Villanova University in 2003, and she graduated cum laude. She earned her Master's of Science in Nursing and her PhD in Nursing, both from UPenn. And Dr. Bronner has a faculty appointment in both the Center for Health Equity Research and the Center for Global Women's Health. She currently teaches several courses with students at UPenn, and she also does this while conducting her adolescent-focused sexual health research. So it is with great pleasure that I bring up to the podium Dr. Bronner, who will talk with you today about When IRBs Still Disagree, Challenges to Conducting Sexual Health Research with Sexually Active Adolescents.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I'll try to speak loudly so you can hear me first. Thank you for waking up probably at 6 or 7 in the morning to come to this session. And I also want to thank my research team, Janae and Naya, wave your hands, for joining us. So this morning, I just want to share some of the challenges that we'll come across for those of you who are in adolescent-focused research or maybe even working with younger children, and what can happen when the regulatory bodies who are a part of your protocol aren't on the same page about your research procedures or some of the things that you're hoping to do. So this is sort of going to be done as a case study format where we present what happened in our process, but then I'm hoping at the end of it just to kind of dialogue to see either what you've come across or some of the things that you think you might face in either implementing a research project or working with this population. I have no disclosures or financial relationships to report. This study, again, is supported by the MARI Initiative, as Dr. Sutton was sharing, and we have a really phenomenal team on the ground in Philadelphia. I'm based out of the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, and in our city, we just have a lot of rich resources that we can use to do the work that we do, and so I'm grateful to have the environment that I have. So there are almost 20 million HIV and STI cases that occur each year in the United States, and half of these are among youth between the ages of 15 and 24. And we know that within that group, there are significant burdens among racial and ethnic minority youth, but we haven't really gotten a handle on what's going on. So we know that it's not just individual behavior. There are a lot of factors that are shaping this, but there's a significant cost burden that is associated with what's happening. And we know that HIV accounts for more than 80% of the costs that are attributed to this. And when we look to see what's going on across not just racial and ethnic lines, but also geographically, we see that areas like Philadelphia and D.C., are also disproportionately affected compared to other areas in the country, and that our younger populations are bearing a significant burden. And one of the reasons why this is important, when we think about who our future presidents, our future leaders, our future, you know, teachers and counselors, this is the demographic that will be stepping into these roles. But if they are dealing with issues that affect both, you know, their sexual health, their mental health, and the way that they live their lives, that will substantially alter and change the way that their future looks. So the central premise for this is we can no longer afford to leave them absent from these discussions. As we're doing this research, as we're developing these programs and identifying, you know, appropriate and valid screening mechanisms, we want to have their voices involved in that process. You know, my passion is for youth who are dealing with mental illnesses, and seeing as how, you know, I won't say my age, but I'm not 14 to 17 anymore, and so I need to make sure that I have that voice at the table in doing the work that I do. having that voice at the table becomes a challenge, again, when the regulatory bodies are not on the same page about the work. So when you do this type of work, for this project, I needed approval from my home institution, my local health department, and then sign off initially by the funder. This can be a challenge if, you know, so for this particular study, there are three kinks in the chain. If one of them is out of alignment, you need all three to be on the same page to move forward. And so it's difficult to have that clearance when that happens. Sometimes controversies can come up around how you obtain informed assent, whether or not parental permission or consent is appropriate or required, and then how a child or a minor is defined. And that taps into some different, like, medical, legal, and ethical issues as far as what people believe is a vulnerable, you know, what do they consider to be a vulnerable population? What do they think needs to happen to make sure that people are adequately protected in research? And then is the research even warranted? You know, is it minimal risk? Is it high risk? What are the factors that they associate? And what we as researchers and those of us interested in working with youth have to be mindful of is that it's a very delicate balance between saying, okay, this is what needs to be done to protect the youth, while also acknowledging their emerging sense of autonomy. And for us, especially in urban environments, it becomes a challenge because youth can navigate pretty much independently and autonomously for healthcare, you know, for school. So it's not that their parents are driving them or going with them as you might see in some other settings. For our study, our project is called Project Gold, We Are Kings and Queens, and basically it's an HIV-STI prevention program for Black adolescents who are heterosexually active and are also diagnosed with a mental health condition. So they're seeking outpatient mental health treatment from one of our community-based mental health providers in the city of Philadelphia. The intervention itself is a two-day, six-hour skills-based program, so we have a lot of fun and upbeat activities from using a decision tree model to help them decide the next steps that a lead character will take to, you know, a Jeopardy game, a lot of ways that we're trying to tie in the content that we're delivering. We're also testing them for chlamydia and gonorrhea through a urine specimen and doing the Oroquick testing for a rapid HIV test. Our primary outcome is consistent and correct condom use. And then the secondary outcomes are sexual activity, looking at the frequency of vaginal, anal, or oral sex, the number of concurrent and sequential sexual partners, and then the laboratory confirms HIV and STIs. And we chose to also include sexual activity as a secondary outcome because even though the youth are currently sexually active, we're also operating under the premise that some may choose to delay further sexual contact until a later point in their lives. So we wanted to be able to assess whether or not they continued to engage in sex after participating in our program. I've already said the levels of approval that we needed. So there were several concerns that emerged across the board, and for the sake of being politically correct and maintaining my position that I so love on faculty, we won't say which boards had each particular concern, but know that somewhere in the chain of three levels of approval, someone had an issue or several people had an issue. One of them was whether or not it would be appropriate to do mixed gender focus groups. Not even just because the adolescents had mental illnesses, but because they were adolescents. So there were some people who believed that it was not appropriate to have boys and girls in the same room for the types of sensitive discussions that we were going to have. But our argument back was, you know, we've been doing this work now for almost 10 years, and if we are training them to communicate about sex and about sexual health, if they will be responsible enough to make the decision to engage in sex, and this is a heterosexual study, so boys having sex with girls, then they would have to be responsible enough to sit in the room and have a conversation together. And the other thing, we have a lot of role playing in the curriculum. So it's one thing to practice that with a girl, but it's another to practice it with the boy, you know, and vice versa. So there's the way that a guy holds his head, you know, like tilts his head when he's really trying to be endearing and gets you to do something, or a way, you know, as women, we arch our backs a little bit when we're trying to make a certain point. So we wanted to pull that in with the curricula content. They also wondered, you know, how would we be able to confidentially recruit adolescents if their parents were present, which was a very valid concern. So if we're saying that we do not want to have parental permission in this study, how can we approach an adolescent while their parent is present and then not tell the parent what the study is about? So what we've decided to do for that is to hand out our, we have a business card for the project, and so we would hand that to the youth and say, we're doing a program here. If you're interested in more information, feel free to call us. And sometimes the parents would say, you know, oh, well, what is this? What is it about? And we would explain, it's a project that we're doing, you know, specifically with adolescents, so for confidentiality, we can't share. We do encourage the youth, if they want to talk to their parents about it, they can at some point, but in the consent, we also make it clear what some of the repercussions are. You know, your parent could ask you if you're sexually active. And we also decided our goal was not to usurp parental rights and authority in this project. So if at any point a parent found out about the study, or, you know, like saw the card and did not want their child to do it, even though that adolescent could technically participate, we didn't want to put ourselves or the health department in that type of situation with their clients. Another was, what would we do if someone tested positive? And there were people who, on one of the boards, were saying that we would have a responsibility to tell the parents. And we were explaining, you can't do that. That violates their confidentiality. You know, there's no way that you could breach that. So there was a lot that was raised, and we just had to walk them through our protocol for how we would handle that. And for this, our HIV STI testing, one of our colleagues yesterday was saying, you know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. So there's an AIDS service organization in Philadelphia that does this testing, and they're coming alongside of us so that it's not our research team running the laboratory results, you know, and doing the collection. So we'll have it go that way. And then also they brought up the consequences of not having parents involved. They could question, you know, if your child comes home with $30 or $50, where did you get this money? You know, where have you been? What are you doing? Or if they do test positive and now they have to seek follow-up care and treatment, would that be on the parents' insurance? And how would that work if they didn't know that their child received a positive diagnosis? And then again, wanting us to inform the parents of positive test results. So in our state, youth between the ages of 14 and 17 can consent to both mental health treatment and HIV STI testing without having to have parental consent. Now, under federal regulations, a minor is a person who has not attained the legal age of consent for the procedure. And so if your research study then involves a procedure that an adolescent or a child could legally consent to, in theory, they are not considered to be a minor. And so the discussion of parental permission or consent would not be applicable. The issue is when there's a difference in how this is interpreted. So we, as the investigators, interpreted the law to say that if a minor is able to consent to these medical services, HIV testing and mental health treatment, that they would also be able to consent to our study because that's what it involves. On the ground, however, even though our participants did not qualify as minors for the purposes of human subjects review, there was a disagreement in how the state law was interpreted. And the main issue was to say they need the mental health treatment and they need the HIV testing, but they don't need your research study. So yes, even though they can consent to those things, they don't have to have your study to have them. And so that's where we had the discrepancy. We had 11 separate meetings. This, if you work with adolescents and run into these challenges, you have to have a fire in your belly for the IRB process, and you know, because it is unnerving, it is challenging, but we stuck to the core, to the voices of our youth. Again, we've had them engaged from the beginning of the project, and they would say things like, if I have to tell my parent that I'm doing this, I will not participate. So now you're faced with either having a youth who potentially is positive and getting them to know their status, or they don't and they continue living the life that they're living without being able to get treatment. We agreed to do a youth-focused third-party review to sort of get on the same page, and so we have a juvenile law center in Philadelphia that determined that our provisions were actually consistent with the Mental Health Procedures Act, which again said that the youth 14 to 17 could consent, as well as with HIPAA, and so they did not require parental permission to be in the study. Why this is important, this was 14 months of this, of going back and forth between all the different boards and regulatory bodies and getting the final review. So that's time that we could have been enrolling people. That's time that we could have been, you know, really advancing the science. And so I have the one arm as a PI that is funded and wants to get the work done, but then the other arm as a nurse who's looking like we potentially have youth who are dealing with chlamydia or gonorrhea or HIV and don't know it, and so now we're delayed in getting this information to them. So some of the lessons that we learned, we have to have conversations with the affected community, so adolescents, parents, you know, our local institutions, our health departments, just to kind of see what is the impact that this is having on our city and what can we do about it. In looking at how adolescent assent and parental permission are viewed, we also want to have these particular discussions with them. So we did engage parents in the process from some preliminary work that we had done, and they were about split. Some wanted the adolescent's results if they, you know, if their child were to participate in a study, and others said, well, I would just want them to know, so you wouldn't even have to tell me. But it takes having that dialogue. So again, we're not feeling like we're violating a parent's rights or going behind their back. And the same for the youth to feel empowered to do this. We need clearer guidelines for the collaborative authority process. So once you have a study that is funded to be implemented in a certain way, how does that then get communicated with the other boards that have to review your work? Or how do you all get on the same page about what has to happen moving forward? And then formalize some of these meetings so that there's dialogue across. So what would happen, you know, three separate agencies that have to have approval, and we, I think one time, were able to get all three together to kind of talk and see what was going on. Other than that, it was me as the PI, you know, running like a chicken with the head cut off between each one, trying to make all the changes and give updates. So in conclusion, we just need clearer guidance for how we interpret and implement our local and federal statutes. They are there, they're written, they've been published, but someone can read it and walk away with a totally different understanding of what they were exposed to. So how do we come up with something that either is universally applicable or that researchers have a leg to stand on, basically, to try to go back and combat some of what's coming out? And then as we develop these formal strategies for talking across multiple agencies, almost to have the conversation earlier so that it doesn't cause these significant delays in the protocol. So this had, you know, financial implications on the study. Some of our sites that we were partnering with, their census, so the number of available adolescents that they had began to drop over time. So we just want to find a way to address these concerns early to kind of avoid some of the issues that come up. Thank you.
Thank you, Bridget, for that excellent presentation. What we'll do is we'll go through a couple of questions now, and then we'll save the bulk for the end so that we can go to Dr. Camacho. Any pressing questions now? Yes, sir, in the back.
Yes, ma'am. I was wondering, is there any specific reason why you guys don't screen the youth for stiffness, or are the rates of stiffness amongst that demographic not that high to warrant a screening?
Excuse me, very good question. So in deciding what we were going to test the adolescents for, it was going with what was most prevalent in our particular area. And then the other piece, just the financial expense of doing the laboratory test for all 128 adolescents. So we chose to go with chlamydia and gonorrhea because they could get them in the same panel. So it was more like a combination of what was really going on in the city and then financially what we were able to do with this. But for future projects, we would like to expand to do syphilis, trich. You know, there's a lot of other STIs, unfortunately, that our youth are affected by. Yes.
First of all, I want to congratulate you. You're so brave.
Thank you.
It's so hard because these kids, you know, it's so deserving. Someone to fight for them.
Yeah.
But, and I wanted to ask, if you think that next time we go to the IRB, it'll be easier?
Yeah, so... I've made a name for myself, to say the least, as it comes to this issue. And this is, I've been battling this with them for years, and this is the time where I just really was like, okay, I can't budge on it this time. But I think now, because we have the legal backing, you know, and I have the document where they have explicitly stated this is what it is and why, that it looks a little different. And I also think it was a learning process for all of us, because me, you know, being a junior investigator, I didn't feel safe enough to go as hard in the beginning to just say, you know, my participants don't even qualify as minors, so your discussion of parental permission is irrelevant, right? Because that's really what it was. So I sort of took a softer approach and went along with them. We ended up having to request a waiver of parental permission, even though it wasn't applicable, but still to request it to sort of appease all parties involved. But now moving forward, because we have this, I can reference this and say, you know, in a previous protocol, this is what happened, this is what we found, and so this population does not qualify, you know, as a minor under our federal and local statutes, and so this is how we're moving forward. Yeah, but it was fun, to say the least.
Thank you for sharing. Okay, everyone, thank you. And we'll come back for other questions later if you like. So next up, we have Dr. Andres Camacho Gonzalez. Dr. Camacho is originally from Colombia. Wanted to make sure I started with that. He is currently an assistant professor of pediatrics at Emory University in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Diseases. He did his training at Einstein in Philadelphia, so a lot of Philadelphia this morning, and he did his ID fellowship at Emory in Atlanta. And so welcome, Dr. Camacho. He's going to talk to us this morning about a study that he's doing in a Metro Atlanta Community Adolescent Rapid Testing Initiative. Welcome, Andres.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And first of all, I want to thank the organization and the APHA for inviting us to participate today. I'll be giving you an update and some preliminary results of our trial, the Metropolitan Atlanta Community Adolescent Rapid Testing Initiative. In terms of disclosures, I've received research support from Bristol-Myers, but anything that I'm going to discuss today or any of the results of this trial has to do with that disclosure. So a couple of years ago, as we all know, the concept of the HIV treatment cascade was introduced, and it sort of revealed the significant gaps that exist between the time of diagnosis, the time of infection diagnosis, all the way to successful treatment of HIV. Of the 1.1 million Americans that are estimated to live with HIV, 25% are virologically suppressed. In the state where I come from, Georgia was ranked fourth highest in the nation of new HIV infections in 2011. And as you see there in the graph, since probably the year 2005, we have not had any significant decrease in the number of HIV infections we see every year. In addition, in 2012, kind of people testing late for HIV infection accounted for 57% of new AIDS diagnoses. The majority of these diagnoses were in adolescents and young adults. That's the reason why we as a clinic, as clinicians, decided to sort of open the boundaries of our clinic and go out into the community to try to help decrease this new number of infections and help reach those patients back into the clinic. And that's how the McCarty model was born. If you look at the McCarty model, basically what it entitles is we are trying to target high-risk populations. We go and do non-traditional testing outside of the medical facility. We try to approach the patient in a multidisciplinary approach, being the patient in the middle, having the medical team, social work, case management, psychological support, and all the actors of the community in order to help that patient get into the clinic a lot quicker. And then the intervention itself was created by pediatricians and pediatric psychologists, targeting specifically adolescents and young adults. Our specific aims were to determine the feasibility and acceptability of HIV testing in non-traditional venues. For that, we did some focus groups as well as ethnographic studies. Focus groups were done in HIV-infected and non-infected youth. And then to determine if the McCarty model improves linkage into care of newly diagnosed HIV-infected adolescents and adults 18 to 24. As I mentioned before, basically the McCarty model included testing and linkage outside of the medical facility, immediate assessment by case management and psychological support, as well as motivational interviewing to try to retain those patients in care. We had a couple of study phases. Phase one included focus group and the ethnographic studies. and enrollment of the control arm. The control arm were patients who were referred to us by regular means, health departments, testing agencies. And then phase two was basically a continuation of the enrollment of the control arm in addition to the enrollment of patients in the venues. So today, in terms of outcomes, our retention rate and the control arm at the time I wrote the proposal was around 60%. The time to first visit was around 9 weeks. With the MacCarty model, we were expecting to increase our retention rate to around 80% and decrease the time of first visit to 2 weeks. Then we followed some linkage and retention parameters, time to first visit, time to second visit, permanence in care after 6 to 12 months, as well as some clinical parameters, CD4, viral load, use of antiretroviral therapy, and as well as psychological scales, stigma, social support, life orientation, distress scales. So today I'll present some of the preliminary data that is coming out of the focus groups, which we started just like last week, so very preliminary. The main objectives of the focus group was to understand where to conduct the ethnographic studies to be able and where to do the venue testing from our own infected youth and uninfected youth. Get to know their opinion about venue testing, if they thought it was a good idea. Get to know their opinion about HIV and the epidemic happening in their age group, as well as to understand their social networks to do targeted testing. So, as you can see, the majority of the population, we enrolled a total of 68 patients, and the majority were males, African Americans. Two-thirds of the cohort was HIV positive. They lived with their parents in the majority. And the level of education, which is one of the concerns, is remember this is 18 to 24, were high school or less than high school. These are the open-ended questions that we did. Basically, it was sort of assessing their knowledge about HIV. It was also kind of understanding where if HIV was at all part of the discussion before having sex and how to make that more acceptable. Where they meeting people to have sex, how to approach them in the community for testing, and how, if you find a positive test, how would you disclose that information to the patient? How would they feel comfortable with it, if at all? Kind of learn a little bit as well about their social networks. This one I chose for as an example of the focus group analysis we're doing. So this is the question of what do you think are the main factors contributing to the increase in transmission of HIV in adolescent and young adult population? And you guys hear me better? Okay. So in terms of the question, what do you think are the main factors contributing to increase in transmission of HIV in the adolescent and young adult population? These are the main key points that arrived from that analysis, in which basically the majority of them really didn't care about acquisition of HIV, which is pretty sad. It doesn't seem like they have that HIV is something that is in their minds at the time of sexual encounters. Second was drug and alcohol use, increasing risky behaviors. Many sexual partners with sex early in their relationships, need for immediate gratification, lack of condom use and protection in general, as well as social media. So these are, as you can see here in the slide, these are the frequencies. We held 17 groups, focus groups, and as you can see, the majority of them were people really do not caring about acquisition of HIV. So these are kind of the problems that you will encounter with youth, which are a lot deeper than we thought of. Another, I'm just bringing some quotes of our patient population. For that same question, what do you think about HIV in your age group is rising faster than in any other population? What are the main contributors? Changing times, technology, and the internet change the game. Change how people in our age group date, meet each other. There are a lot of go-getters in our generation, people opening clubs, organizing sex parties, find out about them on the internet and Facebook. To the question, what do you know about HIV and where did you learn about HIV and other STIs? Well, I didn't learn about about it until I started coming to the clinic. At that point, it's too late because they're already HIV infected. And for the question, what do you think would be the best thing to tell someone after they get a positive HIV diagnosis? They responded, I wish that the lady who gave me my results had told me that I am here if you need me. Talk, not just go your separate ways. I'm always here to talk to you if you need anything, and I'm here. That would have been so much better. Instead, I had to go home and be by myself, and she said I was positive and I didn't have anyone to talk to. The second portion of the focus group was some survey data that we did in an ACASI system, and sort of asking again questions of where they meet, some of the risk factors for HIV acquisition, where do they hang out. And so as you see in the slide, the majority of people are doing a lot of nightclub, mall, bars, parks, malls, friends' houses, where the most common places where they hang out. Where do they meet and where do they meet to have sex? Social network was overwhelmingly the majority. And I'll talk about this a little bit later in another slide. When we asked them about risk factors, are you having sex for food? Are you having sex to pay for your living expenses? Are young adults having sex for drugs? And the vast majority said yes to both three of those questions with the percentages that you see in the slide, which is another tremendous problem that we encounter in our patient population. For questions such as on a scale of 1 to 10, what extent are young adults having sex without protection? The majority were. On a scale of 1 to 10, do you think young adults are afraid to get tested? The majority are. Do you think young adults would like the idea of getting tested in places where they hang out? Sort of split. The majority said yes. Do you think young adults choose not to go to the physician despite knowing their HIV diagnosis? Overwhelmingly, yes. When we compare this by HIV, by infection status, we didn't find any differences between infected and uninfected. We were not powered to look at those differences, but it sort of reflects the homogeneous group that we had in our focus groups. As we saw that the mobile apps were such a high percentage of our patients were using them to meet other people and to have sex with other people, we try to quantify a little bit better how much they were using those apps and how often they were really meeting people here. And it's from a scale to 1 to 10, we asked them, from 1 to 5, we asked them, how often are people in your age group using apps or websites to meet people? And you see there the majority with a mean of 4.6 in both groups. When we asked them how many hours a day do you spend in those apps, a lot of them spend more than 5 hours. So that's, if you're a young adult and you're spending 5 hours in your phone trying to meet people, that's a lot. And that just in itself says a lot. So partial conclusions, venue testing seems to be a well-accepted intervention to the majority of our participants. Social networks are not only used to meet people, but are also our gateways for sexual interaction. Time spent in social media and mobile phone applications by adolescents and young adults is significant and may be a driver of high-risk behaviors. And better strategies are needed to promote HIV education and condom use in Atlanta youth. I want to acknowledge my team, my study team, the McCarty team, as well as the CDC for their support, my Emory collaborators, Grady Health System, and our patients, the Atlanta Police Department, and some of the community members at Atlanta and AHF. Thank you.